Paul Howard has joined us in studio. You're part of this story in a way, which is a broccoli story.
You mentioned the broccoli story earlier on. I'm getting text messages from all my friends saying, you idiot, did you really go to the shop buy 2 pounds of broccoli?
I love your list of, we have to go through your list of Larry David moments. I thought I was bad. Look, I won't even try and trump yours because yours are up there. We'll just do one more. Good morning, Ray, from sunny Florida. When I was 5 and visiting cousins in London, my 8-year-old sister and I went to the shop to get bun papers to make some queen buns. The store owner sent us home with 12 single rolls of toilet paper. See, bun papers, bun paper. Yeah. Great to see you, Paul.
Likewise. Great to see anyone. Great to be out of the house. Great to be anywhere that isn't home at the moment.
Yeah, social contact. Braywatch is the new Ross O'Carroll Kelly book. And you've great fun coming up with the titles.
Yes.
Yeah. And we were thinking, well, why not Breakation?
Yeah, Breakation was one option.
Oh, was it? Right.
Viva Las Vegas was another option.
Right. 50 Shades of Bray.
50 Shades of Bray was another one. Right. This was one of those ones where I think I had like 15 or 20 potential titles all related to Bray, you know, puns on Bray.
Yeah, yeah.
There were no shortage of them. I liked Braywatch. There's... I suppose it was an excuse to show a bit of Ross's flesh on the cover as well, you know. His belly is belly is starting to go over the
sort of a muffin
shorts,
top.
An untrimmed pie, as they say, you know.
Yes.
And those sort of iconic red Baywatch shorts as well, you know. So
what age is he now?
He is 40. In real, so I've been writing about Ross since he was 16, going on 17, and I mean he's no more sensible now than he was at 16, or no more intelligent. He's regressing, I think. But
but you don't get more intelligent.
But
I think you're born with a certain level of intelligence, are you?
Yeah, and you lose it. Yeah, I think so. The process of being stripped away. But yeah, I mean, I've always wanted to write a book based on Bray because. Bray is Ross's idea of a nightmare. I think, you know, that roundabout, the Loughlinstown roundabout, like he's always has this nightmare. He's going to take the wrong turn off it and end up in Bray. But Bray is a place that's really dear to me. I spent a lot of my kind of teenage years and 20s hanging out in Bray. I have lots of great friends there. I socialised there for lots and lots of years. And I got a letter from the Chamber of Commerce about 2 years ago. And they said, you know, while your books are very funny and everything, have you ever thought about writing anything nice about Bray? And Ross always refers to Bray as Bray of all places. He can't conceive of it except as Bray of all places. So I said, I actually hadn't thought about kind of putting Ross in the Bray that I know, which is just a great town. So I had this idea that Ross would go back and become a school's rugby coach again. And he's not coaching his old school team of Castle Rock. He's going outside and he's taking on the job of coaching Presbrae. So it's this school that's probably underachieved in rugby terms in that they've produced a lot of Irish international rugby players over the years, but never a school's cup winning team. Well, certainly not for 60 or 70 years. And Ross goes out there and, you know, it's possibly the sea air, the good sea air, but he decides I can do something with this team. Yeah. And the first job is to convince them that, you know, it's not just about keeping the score down against Blackrock College in the first round. They can actually get to the final and win it.
Right. Have you seen Ted Lasso?
No.
On Apple Plus?
No.
I think you'd enjoy it because it has echoes of the book in it.
Oh, okay, right.
It's a guy who comes from American football to coach a premiership side.
Oh right, okay.
It's on Apple Plus. It's very funny. I can't remember the guy's name. He stars in it, writes it, directs it. You know, one of those type of things. Yeah. So I'll probably say this to you every time, but are you now, a record breaker in that? Are you the most prolific Irish writer of all time?
I don't know if I am. I think this series probably is. I mean, because like there are more Ross books than there are
anything else.
Yes. I mean, you know, even Jeeves and Worcester books, there are more Ross books than Jeeves books and Flashman books and James Bond books. So it's certainly the longest running Irish series.
Yes.
But I don't know.
Have you got on to the Guinness Book of Records? No, I'm serious though.
Yeah,
I'm serious.
I, um, I haven't thought of it, but yeah, I mean, I will.
Yeah, you should.
As soon as I leave here, I'll make that phone call. Yeah,
you should. They're very receptive to, you know, and they're very helpful people on the phone.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're always looking for new things. I think that'd be great. That'd be great. So we'll come back to Ross later on, but I laughed out loud on a number of occasions. My top 20 Larry David moments. People would hear you on the radio and see you on telly.
Yeah.
And read Ross or Carol Kelly and know that you're that prolific and you produce a book every year.
Yeah.
You wrote the Dermot Bannon, the opera. You've written Copperface Jacks, the musical. You're a very accomplished together person.
But I'm also an idiot.
Yes. It's brilliant that you were willing to. Where did this come from? Was it your wife wrote them all down?
I made it, Mary. Yeah, me and Mary, it was kind of one of our lockdown projects, you know, to write down all my idiotic moments. It was quite soul cleansing, actually. You know, I was worried I was kind of repressing something. But there's a Christmas time, this isn't on the list. But last Christmas, I walked into a packed post office in Avoca Village, where we live, and in front of like 15 people, I posted all my letters into the Santa box, right? And I never heard of a Santa box, right? I just thought, because it was Christmas, they had wrapped the regular post box up in wrapping paper just to make it look nice, and it said Santa's letters. And apparently, after I left, I went in and everybody watched me do it. And after I left, everybody burst out laughing in the post office, and then they all went in and fished out my letters and put them in the real post box. So after Christmas, I went to the post office, and Mary, who runs the, not my Mary, but Mary, who runs the post office, told me about this, and she tears rolling down her face as she was telling me the story. And I went home and told Mary about it. And then that was when we kind of started scribbling down. Yeah, I was telling her some of the other things I'd done. My wife, Mary, has lots and lots of stuff on me, like things I've done over the years.
And things you probably didn't even remember.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. For 2 years on and off, I wore an aftershave that turned out to be women's perfume. I'd say a lot of people do that. I found, and look, it's just coincidental, maybe it's just me, but there was a row 14, 15, 16, 17 and 18 of the 20. They just got better and better.
Right, okay. My favourite. I can't remember them now.
Well, my favourite is the badminton club. The badminton club. It's like, did this actually happen?
Yeah, this happened in 1991. Right. I got a phone call from a badminton club in South Dublin. Right. They said, we want to make a presentation to you to say thank you for highlighting our club. And I'd written quite a bit about their players, like when I was working as a local reporter for Southside. And so they said, we might like to make a presentation. So I went along to this community hall and they gave me this clock, a lovely clock. I still have it. It's this Paul Howard Sports Personality of the Year and the name of the badminton club. But for some bizarre reason...
How many people were there? What was it?
Not many, right. Like 12.
Oh, right.
Like 12.
Right.
Like it wasn't hundreds, I bet 12 people. But one of them thought it would be hilarious to order a strippogram for the occasion. So I'm standing there with this clock. This woman came in and she's kind of wearing these thigh-high boots and this sort of leather bodice. And she started reading out this poem about me. There was lots of kind of double entendres around the word shuttlecock and things like that. And then she started hitting me with this kind of leather truncheon thing, right? This was like 3 o'clock on a Wednesday afternoon. And you know, I still think back on it. I mean, I still think back and I say, did that really happen? But it really did happen. I mean, I remember it really well.
But they didn't know you that well. Like, who in the right mind would book a stripper for somebody? Like, very odd.
I mean, that's very strange.
That's brilliant. Yeah.
That's when I hear the Larry. That's why I call them Larry David moments. Yeah. I hear that music.
We did the broccoli one already.
The one outside the stadium in Italy is probably my favourite on the list.
Go on.
Mary and I we got tickets to a Champions League match. We're in Rome and we got tickets to Roma against Atletico Madrid. And we're walking towards the ground and there's a big carnival atmosphere outside. Now, so I'm only giving you that as context, right? Right. So you understand why I did what I did. I'm walking towards the ground. There's, you know, people are jumping around the place and singing and dancing. And a woman walked towards me with her arms outstretched like this. And I hugged her. It was just an instinctive thing. I gave her a big hug. And Mary said, I think she's trying to search you, Paul.
The embarrassment. When you were 15, you were walking through Parnell Square. Two girls smiled at me. I smiled back and walked into a parking meter. You see, that's
right in the chest. Yeah. It got me right in the chest. I was walking pretty fast as well. And I ended up winded on the ground, just lying on the ground, my legs kicking in the air. And nobody helped me because everybody was laughing. Everyone was too busy laughing. Like, yeah. I was rolling around on the ground.
You could have been badly hurt. A friend of mine, huge fan of Gabriel Byrne, you know, this is about 20 years ago. She was walking up Baggot Street and she spotted him walking the other way and just like, and then they sort of, their eyes might have met and then into a lamppost. Like it was like, you couldn't write these things.
But it's slapstick though. It's always funny,
yes,
isn't it?
It's always funny. Yeah. It's always funny, even if people are hurt badly. Yeah. So this thing, so you're at home a lot. You do get the call, you get nuisance calls, you get scam calls. So this particular one,
yeah. Oh, yeah. I get these calls quite a bit, actually. It was a woman who just said, you may have a virus on your computer. And I know them when I answer the phone. It's you can kind of tell by the number that it's a scam call. You may have a virus on your computer. And this day, I was just so annoyed. I was really busy. I was quite stressed. And they'd rung like four or five times. And I answered the phone and I let out a volley of abuse. And there may have been swear words used as well. And then I hung up. And about 10 minutes later, the phone rang again. I picked it up. And it was a man who said he was her supervisor.
Right.
I said, you have supervisors there? He says, yeah. And he said, you really upset my colleague. I said, but you people are trying to rob me. And he said, yeah, but we're still entitled to be treated with respect. So... But the weird thing about this was I actually engaged him in conversation. We had a debate that lasted sort of 10 or 15 minutes about whether thieves were entitled to be treated with respect.
I was talking to somebody recently, and I better not give their name, but a pretty high profile person in Ireland. And one of their social media things was hacked into. And a guy was on the phone and he was going, we need $300 in Bitcoin, you know.
Yeah.
And your man was saying, but this is the way the conversation went. We do this all the time. Just relax. We're talking through it. You know, like they have standards, Paul.
No, I was trying to imagine in this, you know, this sort of warehouse where all these scam calls are being made. And, you know, the moment at the water cooler where the woman said, God, I just had the most horrible guy on the phone to me. Oh, I'll ring him. I'll talk to him. It was very strange.
So, like, there is, you know, you did you ever think of writing a Larry David type? I suppose everybody thinks they have a Larry David sitcom in them, do they? Or
maybe. I think in those moments, I'm kind of living them, you know? I wouldn't be thinking to myself, God, this has made good television. It's just the cringe, the embarrassment.
Yeah.
And then the bizarreness of these situations. Like one that didn't make the list. We were trying out one of those kind of television packages, you know, this sort of experimental thing. And a box came to the house, you know, and we plugged it in. And we decided after about 3 or 4 days, we didn't want it. So Mary arranged for a courier to come and collect the box. And I was on the phone when he arrived. So he came in, I went, pointed in the corner and he took the box and he went away.
Yeah.
But he'd taken the wrong box. He took our modem, right?
All right, so internet,
and he was gone
no telly.
So about 5 hours later, I realised that the internet was gone and the guy wouldn't bring it back. He said, no, I have to deliver it. But I said, but it's not theirs, it's ours. So eventually, with the compromise was, we would meet at a petrol station off the M50.
And exchange
it. I would get my modem back, you know.
Maybe right, that final, final one then. You were staying in a B&B in Earl's Court in London.
Oh, yeah. This is one of the ones where I think, God, I can't believe I wrote that in a newspaper, but I did. Staying in a B&B, I was having a shower and I had a notebook with me that I knew I needed that day and I had to check, was it in my pocket? And I knew I would forget it if I didn't check. So I got out of the shower, dripping wet, no towel around me, you know, completely in the buff. Went out, put my hand, got my jacket. It was one of those kind of bubble jackets, you know,
yeah,
full of feathers.
Yeah.
Put my hand into my pocket, found it, pulled it out. It was one of those ring spiral notebooks.
Yes,
so it tore the pocket. And I pulled it really hard and a thousand feathers must have come out of that pocket.
Right. So you're naked.
So I'm naked, standing in the room, covered in feathers everywhere, some of them on me, a lot of them in the air. And at that moment, with the timing of somebody from a Carry On movie, housekeeping walked into the room, right? Pushed the door, shouted housekeeping and pushed the door at the same time. And I'm standing full frontal, covered in feathers, feathers in the air. And she screamed and then ran out of the room.
And then she said, I'll come back when you're on your own.
My room wasn't cleaned for 2 days afterwards.
That's brilliant. We had you on the telly talking about your book, A Day in the Life, was it?
I read the news today.
And a main part of that was the house, Lugalaw House. And that's been sold, and the documentary was on recently. And do you know much about it, who owns it, or what's going to happen with it? Or
I don't. Well, I know he's an Italian count who bought the house. I haven't met him. I've only been back to the house once. I haven't been back to the house since Gareth's ashes were scattered on the lake. That's the only time. And there's a bit of me doesn't want to go back, doesn't want to see it again.
Because and you interviewed him, did you?
I mean, I spent 10 years working on the book. So I spent a lot of time in Gareth's company. And, you know, probably a couple of hundred days in the house with Gareth. And he was the house, really, you know. And I know a lot of people are kind of talking about what's going to become of the house. But I kind of think once Gareth has gone from it, I just can't really sort of conceive of the house without him. So I don't really want to go back. When I was there for his ashes scattering, they scattered his ashes on the lake. I kind of said goodbye to Lugalaw and kind of that part of my life. I think I'd find it very sad to go back and to know he wasn't there.
Remind people about it. So he was this sort of, he was a linchpin for musicians and society people.
Yeah. Gareth had this idea that he was going to revive that traditional Irish music. You know, a lot of artists and a lot of music that would have been lost if he hadn't done this, you know. And he went around the country with Tara, when Tara, his brother, who I wrote the book about, Tara was very young, Gareth was a little bit older. They had one of these Grundig two-reel tape recorders, and they went around recording all of these pipers and singers and storytellers and Shannos singers. And he formed Cladder Records and kind of put a lot of this stuff out, and then was instrumental in founding the Chieftains and making traditional Irish music kind of cool, you know, giving them those great covers. When Gareth got involved in this traditional Irish music, you couldn't really buy an album that didn't have a shamrock or a rainbow or a leprechaun on the cover. And he kind of, those Chieftain albums just looked brilliant, you know, the photographs and everything were great. So that's what he was involved in. Uh-huh. You know, that's what he gave his, one of the things he gave his life to.
Right. So it remains to be seen what the Italian count does with the house.
Yeah.
He paid 26 million?
I think it was 28 million. 28
million.
Read. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
How many acres?
God. I mean, I think there's 5,000 acres up there.
Wow.
But it's the beauty of it as well. I mean, I just, you know, just opening the curtains in the morning and looking out and seeing.
And was there talk of the state buying it at one stage?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I think they were quite keen for it to stay in, you know,
Irish
they were keen
hands,
for it to go into public ownership. Yeah.
Right. Any more books like that in the pipeline?
No, I mean, that one was 10 years
in the making.
I mean, I kind of it became my life really for all those years. Right. I haven't started anything that I've put that much time into.
I'm basically Larry David as well. I was house hunting a few years ago and got caught short while viewing a house. I had to do a number two in the house while other potential buyers viewed the place. The auctioneer was fuming. I know I didn't. I should have pre-read that. Sorry about that. Ordered my signed copy pre-order during lockdown and then forgot all about it. Just arrived yesterday. Braywatch. What a great surprise. Read the first few chapters last night. Brilliant, says Colm in Galway. And I followed his books for a decade. He's hilarious, somebody else. And thank you. You gave me such a laugh during lockdown. The Ross columns were great. And that became, I'd say, people's Saturday morning. Not that it wasn't beforehand, but it became more of something to look forward to on a Saturday morning.
I just love writing the lockdown ones. At the beginning, I was thinking, right, Ross is going to be in the house now for 4 months. How on earth am I going to write about Ross being stuck in the house?
But the banana bread one was particularly funny.
Yeah. A lot of people put banana bread on my doorstep, actually, after that column appeared.
They?
Yeah. Right. Everybody in the country seemed to be, there was a mania for making banana bread and swapping banana bread. And in the column, for those who didn't read it, Surika sends Ross out with like 8 loaves of banana bread to give it to the neighbours, and he comes back with 12. Now they can't get rid of all this banana bread.
Yeah. I'm a man who wore perfume for 3 years by accident. Everyone loved it.
Yeah,
they're sort of androgynized now.
Some of them are, like, you know, there's a lot. I remember CK1 about when it was cool about 20 years ago or something. That was for men.
I'm still wearing that.
But this stuff I was wearing, when I smell it now, it was
I don't know how I
thought it was after.
It was fruity.
It was very fruity.
Yeah. So, like, still as busy as ever. How's Humphrey the dog?
Oh, he's great. Yeah.
What age is he? Because we were talking
he's 10 now.
Right.
Yeah, he's getting older. He's getting a little bit slower. He's a basset hound. Yeah, he used to bound up the stairs, and now I hear, you know, he comes up really, really slowly. He's going grey. You know, his facial. He used to be brown and white and black, and now he's nearly all white in the face. He's getting very affectionate, actually, as he gets older. But he's been doing this thing during lockdown when I'm working. I don't know why he started it during lockdown. He lies on the back of my chair on the casters, and he does it because he wants an alert if I'm getting up to go to the kitchen to fix myself something to eat. His big fear is that he would miss a meal or would miss me. So to move, I have to wake him every time.
Yeah. So there's no signings, is there? That's not
sadly
possible.
Not. No. It's the first year in 20 years
I haven't
done a signing, and I'm heartbroken about it because I really enjoy sitting in the shop and actually talking to people, you know, and meeting readers and hearing stories. But
and there's that, just very quickly now, the last one from your list of Larry David ones where you were mistook for another writer.
Oh yeah, all right. I was in Dubray in the Blackrock shopping centre, and somebody came up to me and said, "I've just realised who you are. I'd written The Curious Incident of the Dog and The Night Dress at the time." Right. And so I said, "Oh," she said, you are my favourite writer, but my husband will die when he hears I've met you. Would you mind talking to him?" And I said, yeah, no problem. So she rings the number, hands me the phone. Or before she handed me the phone, she said, "You'll never guess who I'm sitting here with in Blackrock. Mark Haddon." And without saying that, she just handed the phone to me.
And that was that famous book about
Curious Incident of the Dog in the Night Time.
Brilliantly written.
Superb book. So the husband said to me, "I have to ask you, how do you know so much about Asperger's syndrome?" And I had a choice. I could just tell him the truth, that it was a terrible mistake, or I could pretend to be Mark Haddon.
And what'd you do?
I pretended to be Mark Haddon for like 10 minutes. And then other people started to come into the shop. She was telling other people in the shop, "Mark Haddon's over here." And I thought, I'm never going to get out of here. I thought, I'm going to be rumbled, you know. I don't know how I did get out.
So there's still a man somewhere in Ireland thinks he's had a 10-minute conversation with Mark Haddon when it was you.
I signed
How do you sleep at night?
I signed her book. I signed her copy of Curious. She bought a copy of it in the shop. I'm embarrassed by it.
Braywatch is in bookshops now. Russell Carl Kelly. Paul Howard, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks so much, Ray.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.